Yeah, but the podcasting part, good gracious. Like it's to me was so much fun. Like it was so much fun, like starting one, like, okay, what are we gonna do? Like this is kind of cool. And now
well,
there's
very low barrier to entry. You really could mm-hmm. just record everything on your phone and have this really low quality effort that would work. And there are people out there who really, they don't edit. They don't really do any polishing. They just record a section of their life and they put it out there. And, mm-hmm. and for some podcasts, that's people want to hear that.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm more on the other end. I like editing and making cuts and having like the perfect thing. I mean, if I did that on Sunday morning, if I just got up and had probably 3 hours of here's all the stuff on my brain right now, that would be a homiletical disaster. And so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to edit and I'm going to let the spirit lead, but I'm going to let the spirit lead while I am doing a rough cut and then an edit. And then I'm refining and I'm kicking things out. And so by the time people hear me on Sunday morning, which I often preach 40 minutes. By the time they hear me on Sunday morning, that is a quarter of the stuff that I had prepared that week. Yeah. And I hope it's the best quarter and presented in a interesting way, but it's not always.
Yeah. Right. Right.
If I was a superhero, my superpower would be putting people to sleep. And so, yeah, just mesmerize them. They'd drift off and yeah, that'd be my superpower.
I doubt it. Well, Jared Altick, welcome to the Homilist Podcast. And
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. I'm glad we connected and it just so happens that there are several different avenues that our lives kind of line up in what we've kind of realized just in our conversations.
We're both named phone. Jared.
That's right. Yes. That's exactly. And we both spell our name correctly.
Exactly. That's what I was just about to say. Yes.
That's right. We both spell it with the right letters and that's good. but just like how this conversation started, like you too are a podcaster. And so yeah. you've got a podcast called Hey Chaplain.
Yeah.
You're also I gotta make sure you're at Wyandotte County Christian Church, correct?
Correct. Yeah. For 21 years now.
21 years. Now yep. I saw something on your website and it looked like it said, not just lead pastor or preaching pastor, but author. Did I see something like the author?
Not really. I mean, not published. No,
no, no, no. But no. Like as a job title, does the website have you named as our
maybe author of blog posts? Yeah. I was a blogger for years.
Oh yeah.
And I'm sure that like, if I post a sermon on our website, it probably lists me as the author of that blog post.
That's what I was seeing. I was looking on and I was like,
well, yeah, I'm an author with a lowercase a in, you know, ad nauseum, perhaps. I mean, like I said, I've been online for years and blogged for years and I've been producing content both in the church and kind of on the side for a long time.
But, yeah. Well, I do know sometimes pastors and preachers get really worked up about what they're called. And I thought, maybe this guy wants to be called.
Oh, no. This guy wants to be called. I'm on the opposite end of that spectrum because I'm in Kansas City where we have a wide variety of different types of churches.
Sure.
And there's plenty of people out there who are the doctor, reverend, so-and-so.
Evangelist.
And some of them are really persnickety about, you better use my complete and full title. And I just don't. In fact, my standard joke when people come visit the church is, hello, I'm Jared. I also respond to, hey, you.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I really mean that. I mean, address me casually and I'm not going to put my name on the sign out front. I mean, obviously I've been at this one congregation for 21 years, but it's not my church. It's Jesus's church.
That's right.
I just work here. And I hope I work here my whole life. If I could spend my entire working ministry years in one church, that would be a dream come true. But I don't presume that God will do that. And so if I can, I will, but it's his church, not mine. And I need to be replaceable. And if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, this church should not miss a beat.
Right.
It should keep right on going and be fine. And actually my podcast is, the reason it's called Hey Chaplain is because of that. You know, I'm not going out there and handing out my business card. Well, I'm Jared Altick and you can address me as sir. You know, I'm not doing anything like that. Right. It's like a lot of these officers, they barely know my name. They just say, Hey Chaplain, and I come running.
That's right. Which brings me to the other role that you have up in the Kansas City area. And that is as a police chaplain.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing that for about 4 years and change. And God just kept putting police officers in my church. And so I had really decades of experience now dealing with military families and law enforcement families, mm-hmm. and honestly making mistakes. There's a lot of folks who were military and law enforcement in my church 15, 20 years ago that I really did not have the wisdom to minister to them well. And I learned and I made mistakes and God kept putting this in front of me. And so finally, after several people had said, hey, you ought to consider being a chaplain, I decided I'd pursue it and got some specific training. And then I bring all of my church experience to the table. And I am a police department chaplain. And I, in fact, today there's a small risk. I have my name badge on and everything, got the police cars parked out in the church parking lot, and I have a pager, and there's a chance this pager could go off. And if it does, I apologize, but that means somebody died. And so there's a homicide or a suicide or whatever. Gotcha. And they'll call me out. And that's part of that job. Is responding to those kind of things and providing victim services, you know, and that is part of what I do as a chaplain. Yeah. And so I don't think they'll call today. I don't get called every day, but I have been called many times, and so it could happen.
Yeah. So while we're on this topic, when you find yourself, I mean, just for other people who are going to hear this, when you find yourself in a church, leading a church, a pastor of a church, or you're the family yeah. minister, and you have a church full of police department guys, fire department guys, you're talking military, first responders, and you have those people in your in your church. What is the one thing that we should understand, especially guys that are brand new in ministry, they're in a church. What's the one thing they should understand about these folks that are coming in their door?
Well, it might be kind of a, you need to know what you don't know. You have not been in their shoes, mm-hmm. and I know you've seen cops on TV, and I know that you feel like you could imagine what they've been through, but the TV doesn't convey the smell of a dead body. It doesn't convey the fear of being behind a car in a traffic stop and not knowing if this is going to be the most benign, harmless little, you know, you're going to give a warning to a little old lady who just was driving too fast, or if it's going to be somebody who's preparing a gun, you know, while you walk up to the car. And we as civilians, people like myself who've never been a sworn officer, we just don't understand that kind of life and death stress, that kind of zero to 90 transition that they go through both directions all the time. And it's important for a pastor not to presume that, well, I'm a pretty smart guy and I've taken counseling classes, so I understand what you're thinking. And we really don't. And that's why it took me, you know, as a chaplain, it took me several years of being in the police car and going to roll calls and being in the, you know, in the police headquarters and also in the police car, where I could witness some of this. And frankly, I think I had to get scared a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I think I had to be in a dangerous situation once or twice and actually get scared, where I'm not thinking rationally and your vision narrows down and you stop hearing, you know, people are talking to you and you're not hearing them because you are legitimately afraid. You have to maybe go through that a few times and I think be around death some before it starts to sink in. Okay, this is what these young officers are dealing with. And my focus is specifically police department and these officers, they took the job because they want to help people. but they deal with all kinds of domestic violence and children being hurt. Mm-hmm. And we're in a city that's large enough that they see dead bodies semi-regularly. It's not every day, but they do see injured, hurt people and dead bodies as well. And that's something that a lot of us are not exposed to. We're sheltered from it. And that's not bad. It's just, if you want to go be a helper, you better understand that you don't understand. And so I'm not saying that a good pastor can't still minister to those folks, but give them some respect. They do stuff that you don't have to do. Mm-hmm. And don't presume like you get it, because you don't. Yeah. You don't get it.
Yeah. And what's been your experience? You're talking about a group of people. They'd score pretty high in openness, or no? What do you find them out?
Cops are an interesting breed. They make themselves deliberately hard to love, and there's all different types of cops. I mean, there are some that are super friendly and outgoing, and you know, very first time I walked into a police roll call, they were like, "Hey, how are you? Glad to meet you." Most of them are not. Mm-hmm. Most of them are going to be skeptical, and they're going to be looking at you, giving you kind of the stink eye, like, "Hey, why is this guy standing in the back of our roll call? Right. We're trying to have a meeting. What's he doing here?" And I don't want to say anything in front of him. And it's funny, I get two reactions from cops. I'll walk in, and especially when I was new, and you could see that they're just talking and they're cussing a blue streak. And they see me walk in and their eyes get big as saucers, and they're like, "Oh no, what did I just say?" And they're like caught with their hand in the cookie jar, you know?
Yeah.
And they're mortified that they were swearing in front of a chaplain. But then there's others who, they have the same mental calculus, but their response to it is, "Well, I'm going to cuss more." Mm-hmm. And so they're blankety blank and blank blank. And it becomes absurd how they're trying to make every other word a really hardcore swear word. Like maybe that'll stiff arm me and mm-hmm. push me away, mm-hmm. I think is what they're doing. I don't think they're thinking it consciously, but I think subconsciously they're like, "Well, if I swear enough, that'll make the chaplain go away." Right. And I just smile and I, you know, I'm unfazed by it, especially now, you know, but even when I wasn't, I pretended that I was unfazed by it. and I just like, no, I love police officers. I am determined to be available to them, to help them if they want me. And I'm not going to be scared off by a 25-year-old cussing a blue streak. That's mm-hmm. just not going to make me run away.
Yeah. Sometimes when new folks come to our church, I do the same thing to them. I just
start cussing
and then I just keep cussing in hopes to stiff arm them. It's not completely true. Most of the time it's not the new people.
most of the time that doesn't happen. Right.
Right. Well, you know, my experience has been very similar, that there's so many of those guys that, and I don't know exactly what it is, but I've got some friends, some close friends that, you know, the police officers, and just how tight-lipped they get about certain things. I tell you the thing, and I'm curious to know on your end how you kind of wrestle with this. So you enter ministry with the mindset of basically like you want to help people, you want to help folks.
Yeah.
And when you're in a position like ours, when you see somebody who's really rough, and you can tell they got 100,000 miles, no oil change, and you can see it on their face, you know.
Yeah.
And they walk in your church, there's a certain, for me anyway, there's a certain amount of excitement to where it's kind of like, man, Jesus is still going after, he's still going after the guy in the Gadareans, right? He's still dragging him in out of the tombs and bringing him in. And there's a mentality of just like now we get to see the gospel really do a thing. When you get with police officers and they encounter a very similar person, the mentality is completely different.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because what you get is, and I've had to wrestle with this a little bit, because these guys are, listen, it's, these guys are dirtbags. This is what they are. They're dirtbags. These are bad guys, you know, mm-hmm. and it's hard to kind of shut my mind off to the place of, if I put myself in their shoes, like that might be the guy that keeps me from going home at night. Where for people like you and I, like when that person walks in the door of the church,
Yeah.
We assume there's been some amount of surrender in their life, or at least they're on the verge of some sort of surrender.
Yeah. And that's an important nuance there. The hardest people to reach, there's a lot of folks who come in needy and they are honest about their neediness. Mm-hmm. And for a minister, that is kind of a, I mean, we don't want anyone to be hurting, but we appreciate that they understand that they're hurting, that they need Jesus, and sure, we're there to help them find Jesus. And that, mm-hmm, so that's really good. But the hardest people to reach are the ones who are, you know, healthy, wealthy, and moral, mm-hmm, and they don't think they need anything. And so maybe they've showed up because of social reasons or whatever, but, sure, but they don't think that they need Jesus. And so it's really hard to convince someone when their life is going great that they need Jesus. Mm-hmm. Now, where that intersects with law enforcement is that a lot of these cops are trained because they're trying to learn to be resilient, because they run into really bad stuff. They have their nose rubbed in the worst of the human element out there. And so they have all these coping mechanisms to try to put on a tough face and to put it all together. And they, you know, they put on the uniform, and they have, like, a lot of them, like a ritual of look, at least from outward appearance, I've got it all together. Mm-hmm. Now, they may be struggling internally, mm-hmm, but they're not going to show that. They don't show the weakness. They have this command presence, and they're the authority figure, and they enforce the law, and they've got it all together. And there's this culture you often see in police departments of this veneer, mm-hmm, of being okay. Well, try to tell a cop that he's not okay. Well, right, he's going to deny it. And, right, and if you ask him, you know, how are you doing? He goes, well, this isn't my first dead body. And, right, you know, I've been around the block a few times and I'm fine. And they're almost never fine. Right.
Yeah.
but they don't want to admit it. And so they don't have an honesty, and they're not encouraged to be honest about, hey, I'm really struggling with something. I'm having nightmares. I'm drinking too much. I'm, mm-hmm, I'm taking this out on my wife and kids and being just really nasty to them.
Or, well, I don't know how to turn off.
Right, right, right. And so there's all kinds of opportunity for dysfunction that by the nature of police culture is going to get covered up. They are going to tell themselves, I'm fine, because I can't let down my buddies. Mm-hmm. I cannot go out there and fail to perform. I can't. Every department in the country is understaffed right now. If I don't feel like coming into work, that means my buddies don't have somebody watching their six. Mm-hmm. And so I have to make myself get out there. I have to put on a brave face, and I have to pretend like everything's okay.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pressure internally and in the culture and externally to be that way. Well, that runs contrary to the gospel, because, I mean, the very first thing is that we have to admit that we're not okay.
Right.
I mean, what's right. Jesus doing if he's not saving us? We need to admit that we need a savior.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's extraordinarily difficult to present the gospel to someone who is almost like a mantra telling themselves, but I'm actually okay. Mm-hmm. I'm fine. Well, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, and so getting past that defensive mechanism, that barrier, is extraordinarily difficult, which is why for pastors and for chaplains ministering to police officers, it takes years, mm-hmm, to earn their trust and to get behind the badge. It's not something you can just, oh, easy 1, 2, 3 steps and I'm in.
Right.
No. You will have to earn your way. Yep. And to where they actually trust you.
Yeah, that was my experience. You know, when we first moved here, it was, I don't know, close to 18 years ago to Iola. I met a couple of cops, and I'm not kidding you. Years later, I had one of them tell me, "Listen, I was skeptical of you for years. Bro, you came to church with us." And he's like, "But dude, I wasn't sure that you weren't, you know, a part of some." And I'm like, gee, man, like, I can't even imagine. Like, I got a big imagination, but
yeah.
I mean, it's definitely a long game, especially, I mean, ministry in and of itself is a long game, which I want to tell you, Jared, that it's really encouraging for me to hear you say something like, listen, if I could be at the same church for the duration of my ministry, like, that would just be, that would be incredible.
Yeah.
Because there's something that I picked up on in our conversations that is different. It's different about you than a lot of the people that we know, because we come from the same school, mm-hmm, and a lot of the people that we mutually know that a lot of times what happens is you see a little bit of a chasing of a platform or trying to get to the next bigger spot. Yeah. And I'm not saying God didn't grab some of these guys and call them to some of these places, but there was definitely some pursuing to get to some.
Yeah, there's some ambition there.
Which I don't have any problem with. I don't have any, like, everybody's
going to
have.
No, that's fine.
That's good. But it encourages me to hear you.
A lot of people, their biblical hero is, a lot of ministers, their biblical hero is Paul. And Paul went from church to church, from one big thing to the next big thing, never stayed anywhere, as far as we can tell, more than about 3 years. My biblical hero, my ministry model is Philip. Philip disappears into Samaria. And then, you know, later in the book of Acts, you know, 20, 30 years later, you come back and him and his daughters are still there preaching in Samaria. I mean, okay, worst place. Okay, and the most, they're drawing out assignments. Who wants to go to Alexandria? Who wants to go to Athens? Who wants to go to Rome? Everyone, me, you know, but who wants to go to Samaria? Nobody. But the guy who went to Samaria stayed there for at least a generation and raised his kids there. Yeah. And I find that incredibly noble. And so we have plenty of people who want to be an Apostle Paul. What about being a Philip and just going to Samaria and you're just there plugging away, preaching the good news and loving people? I think that's admirable. And I don't think it gets enough attention. You know, when people are training for ministry, they all want to be the Apostle Paul.
Yeah. Which I'm for that. Like, I mean, there's a lot of great conferences you can go to.
We need an Apostle Paul
absolutely,
or two.
Absolutely.
Maybe not 200.
Not all of them.
I need more. I want to see more people who are willing to be steadfast and stay in one place, to bloom where they're planted, to not be ambitious. I mean, I said a minute ago, it's no big deal if somebody's ambitious, but Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, he said, and most of our English translations say something like, you know, make it, or try to lead a quiet life or something like that. But we had a Greek professor in Bible college who said, you know, really, you could translate this as make it your ambition to not be ambitious. and that's a quiet life.
Yeah.
I think a minister should maybe take stock of that. I mean, there are a few ministers who are built to be high speed, low drag, go out there, make a big splash and preach to millions. But the kingdom is built on thousands of us who are just going to stay in Samaria. Mm-hmm. And you know, Kansas is a great place to live, but there's also a lot of things that aren't that great about it. And that's okay. That's okay. I'm willing to raise my family here. I'm willing to love the people here. And I sometimes wish it were Miami Beach or, you know, glittering, you know, whatever city you want to look at.
Right.
But it's, this is where God put me. And so I want to serve him well here and stop constantly looking past the people here, hoping that I could go somewhere where I could get paid more, or I could go somewhere where more people would know me or whatever. I need to just focus on what the Lord has given me to work with right here.
Yeah. You know, and it can sound a little bit like, well, it's really easy for a couple of nerds to criticize some of these guys that are right. It could be a little bit of that. But here's the other part. If you don't stay in one place for a long enough time, there are some things in ministry that you will never, ever, ever know. There's some sweetness that you will never, ever experience. Like there's some richness and some depth that you will never, ever know if you are constantly bouncing. Because, and here's another one. If you don't stay at a place for very long, you may always be on one side of the church, reaching out and showing the church to other people. But when you stay at a place for the duration, a lot of times what you find out is now the church becomes a church to you as well. That's a powerful, powerful thing, especially in the times that you desperately need that, you know, you desperately need that.
I've heard it said, and I can't quote my references here, but I've heard it said that you're not really a family's pastor until you've known them for 7 to 9 years. Hmm. And if that's accurate, then most preachers, most ministers, they come and go in half of the time that they needed to really have that family feel connected and feel like, okay, we can trust this person. We're talking about cops being skeptical. I mean, really, I think all human beings are. And, yeah. And so you have to show that you're not trying to take advantage of them. You are trustworthy. You're not going to gossip about them, that, that you really are a reliable minister of the gospel. And that takes years to do it. And so whether you're wanting to be a successful minister in a church, or whether you're wanting to be a police chaplain, you're going to have to spend some time. And if you're like constantly restless leg, I got to go, I got to do something else, then, you know, there's a niche for you, but that's probably not going to be ministry in the local church. And it's probably not going to be police chaplaincy. Yeah. You know, if you've got to get up and change scenery every 18 months, then maybe you need to be like an author and write a book or something, or maybe you need to do something where you can hit people remotely with your message. But if you, but relationship takes time.
Yeah.
And so either you're going to have to ask the Lord to change that in you, or you're going to have to look at a different way to serve him, because some of these jobs, I just think it's baked into the cake that you need to be steadfast and reliable. And too many people are not reliable. Too many people are like, well, I might be here tomorrow, I might not be. And I know that none of us can say for sure, but as much as it depends on us, let us be reliable. Let us be steadfast. Because there's a lot of people in this world that they've never had an authority figure, be it a parent or a boss or whatever, that they could count on for any length of time.
Right.
So let's show that. Let's show that, that we can be the ones that you can count on. We're still going to be here tomorrow. We're not going to get up and leave you.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this just from experience, and I'm sure you've experienced this too. If you are going to try to minister to first responders, it's very similar to trying to minister to other ministers.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of similarities. You're
trying to help helpers.
Spiritual first responders and physical first responders. Not saying that first responders aren't doing a spiritual. I believe they are.
Oh yeah.
But there is still a mindset that you get around a group of preachers. How you doing? Everybody's good. Everybody's fine. Right. Everybody's put together. No, absolutely.
Yeah, doctors make terrible patients.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
true of us too.
A buddy of mine who said, I can't remember the numbers exactly. Somebody'd have to look this up. But, you know, the town drunk, lives to be an average age of 68 years old.
Okay.
The town doctor typically lives to be 62.
You know? Yes.
Something along those lines. It's like, why does that happen? You know?
Yeah.
Like,
because we don't take good care of it. We're so busy taking care of everybody else, but don't take good care of ourselves.
That's right. Well, hey, I got a couple of questions I want to kind of leap into.
Excellent.
Then I want to talk a little bit more about the police chaplaincy stuff.
Sure.
Right out of the gates, one of my favorite questions. You've probably heard it before. What passage of scripture really makes you laugh? You got a story, a passage.
Oh, and I've heard you ask other people this, and they've given such good answers. You know, and I'm not going to have anything original. I don't have any like, oh, you really ought to check out, you know, that one.
I don't know if you've seen this one.
Minor Prophets that no one else has read. Right. No, I don't have anything like that.
Right.
You know, I appreciate that there is humor in sometimes in some of the more obvious places, like Jesus saying, you know, take the plank out of your own eye. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty strong hyperbole. And I think people snickered when he said it, you know, a plank, you can't put a whole piece of lumber in your eye, but if you stop and think about it, you go, oh, well, you know, my problems actually can be pretty big and I can be blind to a really large problem. And that's kind of funny. That it'd be like a whole piece of lumber in my eye. How could I miss that?
Yeah.
And that I feel like there's a very wise kind of humor sown all through the Bible like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Aaron, you know, saying that, oh, well, you know, this golden calf just sprang out of nowhere, you know, like boom, it just popped out. You know, right, well, that's nonsense.
Right.
You spent all day working on that, you liar, you know, and I think that's funny. And so, there's just all the standard ones are the ones I find funny.
I tell you what, this last week I was preaching on, Luke chapter 2, starting from 39 to 52, where Mary and Joseph leave Jesus in Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. And that interaction, that exchange, you know, Jesus is now 12. And so we're at this bar mitzvah age. So he's no longer his mother's son.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's now his dad.
Man.
That's right. Yes, now it's dad's boy. He's now a son of the law. Now he's the, mm-hmm. And one of the just, and it's, I don't know if it's funny as much as it's just really interesting to see that, you know, for the first 12 years, his mother would have been saying, someday you're going to grow up and take over your father's business. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like your father's a carpenter. You're going to go be a carpenter and you're going to take over what you're going to do is you're just going to go be about your father's business. That's what you're going to go be. And then it's almost like at 12, there was this realization, this awakening, this like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. I see. And almost confusion when Mary says to him, why did you do this? Which is really interesting too, right?
Right.
When you lose your child, you're not worried about, like, you're worried about your child, but then when you find them, you've stopped worrying about the child. And now you're mad about you. Like yes, you did this to me. Like, why did you, know what I mean? And so Mary scolds him. Joseph is absolutely silent. Doesn't say a single word, you know, which I imagine he's like, Mary, listen, he's a grown man. Like he's a young man. He's going to be fine. Like, don't tell me he's going to, like, you remember what Simeon, you know, like the whole, there's going to be a sword at some point. And you know, just this panic.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good point.
And,
yeah.
And then when she sees him and she says, why would you do? And it's almost like confusion. And Jesus goes, why were you looking for me? Like, I believed what you said that I would be about my father's business. Like, almost like this, like,
and I really do believe that, you know, the incarnate Christ, that he knew, he had some love, even at 12 years old, I think he had an understanding.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much, and I don't know where the boundaries of that are, but I think he understood. And I love that the Holy Spirit gave us that story.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
That we get that insight to it. I think it's poignant and meaningful.
Who are the who are the people scriptural, it can be scriptural characters, but preachers, comedians, podcasters, people who've inspired you, people who've influenced your life?
I love good thinkers. Mm-hmm. And so, like, a lot of pastors, I can't get enough of, you know, C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton and others, you know, Malcolm Muggeridge and many, many others too. A lot of people who wrote and were able to think and write very clearly. That stuff just really moves me. That I have total respect for that. I admire that. Then there've been, you know, people who, like I was talking about Philip earlier, that are just steadfast, and they're willing to quietly sacrifice themselves over the course of a long time. And we see the soldier jump on the grenade, and we give him a Medal of Honor posthumously, because that one brief moment of bravery really moves us. But what about the moment of bravery that took 45 years to play out? I that touches me, that somebody stayed with it and put in the long work to raise those kids, or to stick with this job, or to invest in this small town, or whatever. That there's something about that I have a huge respect for now at this middle part of my life, where when I was a kid, I'd be like, oh, why don't you go out and do something interesting, you know? Right. And I see it completely differently now. And so great, clear thinkers who can communicate their clear thinking, that means a lot to me. And then people who are invested and steadfast and can do the same job for a long time. Mm-hmm. That used to be common. A lot of people would go to work at the factory and they'd stay there for 40 years. And that just isn't the case anymore. We live in a mercenary culture. And so people are always willing to jump ship for the better paycheck. Mm-hmm. And sometimes literally, sometimes a little more figuratively in regard to the paycheck, they just see a better opportunity. And so they'll jump out of their marriage, mm-hmm. or they'll jump out of friendships or whatever, because they see a better deal. You know, they think the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. Right. And that, I think being in the church, I've seen people do that to other people, and that kind of burns me a little bit. And being in a larger city, there's a church on every corner. Yeah, and so if somebody doesn't like, you know, me stepping on their toes on a Sunday sermon, well, they'll just, I mean, there are dozens of options. They passed other churches to get to this one, I'm sure.
Right.
And so they'll just drop in one of those other churches and it's no big deal. And they have kind of that mercenary, very consumer oriented, you know, well, what's in it for me kind of attitude. And so I think that also sets me against that way of thinking. And I'm like, well, I'll show you, I'll just dig in and I'll love you whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm just going to be here whether you want me to or not.
Yeah. You know, my wife teaches second grade. And one of the things that I'm absolutely amazed with, and I tell her this all the time, that like, I'm so amazed at people who can wake up, go to the same job every single day, do the same thing every single day. And then like in a 9-month period, listen, she has to start all over with a new group of, a new group of dumb kids. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
she,
and the nobility,
that's crazy to me.
The nobility of, okay, I'm going to help this second grader through the second grade, but you don't get to see the finished product. They're 10 years away from graduating high school.
Yeah.
And so they're, I mean, at the end of all your labor, all you have is a third grader.
Yeah.
And yet that second grade teacher gets up and does it again and again and again, because it's valuable.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't have the big splashy payoff that everybody seems to want nowadays, that there's a nobility to, I'm going to contribute my part that is essential, but there's not an obvious payout of glory for me. I'm just, you know, I'm going to take a first grader, I'm going to turn them into a third grader.
That's right.
That's what second grade is. And I'm just going to keep doing it because I love these kids and they will benefit from it. Even if they forget who I am, which I bet they remember their second grade teacher's name.
Well, and what's crazy is it points to the motivation that they're doing it too. Like if you were to ask my wife, you know, why do you teach second grade? And to her, it's, listen, this right now is a very, very important time in their life. Mm-hmm. And I want to be the stable thing in their life.
Yes.
Because
yes.
Like this matters most. Yep. And it's, to me, it's just like, I find myself to be very, very, very selfish and self-interested and self-absorbed when I hear her say something like that. I'm just like, you're willing to just fall into the backdrop of this kid's life and be this for 9 months, you were important.
Yeah.
That is crazy. I mean, and it's noble. And those people,
it's noble. It's good. It's good. And really, society is built on thousands of people doing
absolutely
that.
Right.
And you need that in every town and every community. Mm-hmm. You need countless individuals who are making that kind of contribution. And we have this, you know, whatever, TikTok culture that says, well, what big impact can I make in the next 90 seconds? We need to help steer people away from that.
Yeah.
That is not everybody's path. Society will literally break down if everybody is only in it for the 30-second big splash. That's just not good for us as human beings.
Yeah, they're the backbone. I mean, people who are banging away and just doing the day in, day out. Like that's the backbone. That's the backbone of where we're. And you know what's really interesting is, as things shift in the local high school, and I see some coaches and teachers kind of phase out, it's funny to me how instantly what I begin to pray for is, Lord, I pray you'll bring in some Christian folks into these places. Like this is bringing some Christian folks into these places, because in as much as I look at high school and I go, look, it's a fleeting thing. Like you're going to go through, get it done. But boy, I tell you what, the older I get, the more I'm like, good gracious. I hope, man, the new cheer coach, she's a Christian. The new weights coach, he's a Christian. The new superintendent, the new principal of the school, he's a Christian. I'm just like, this is getting good now. Like this is, like, I can't go do that. I will substitute teach on occasion, you know, and I'll go in and be like, okay, like this is good for Jared because Jared needs this kind of discipline, this kind of structure sometimes. It's good because I need to be around young men to push, to challenge. Like I need to go do this. I'm telling you what, by the end of the day, it's like, I probably won't do that for another week or two, you know, maybe month. Like I'm just, that's just a little too confining. So, but yeah, I'm with you. Those people really inspire me as well. Your preaching style, your preaching style, how would you best describe it?
Heavily influenced by people, and some of your audience will know these folks, people like Mark Scott, personally influenced by, you know, him, had him as professor. People like Matt Proctor, just just a solid, you know, he tells all of his dad jokes in his sermons, but he really, there's a craftiness to what he's doing. There's a technical skill that I listened to it, and you know, everyone else is groaning at the dad joke, and I'm like, oh no, this was clever. This was well constructed. That's craftsmanship right there. And so I had people that were in my life through Ozark Christian College and other places that you know, I felt like, okay, I can take something from this person and something from that person. Certainly historical preachers, people that, you know, like a Fred Craddock or somebody like that, where there's recordings that I could listen to somebody that's long gone, but I really get something out of how they tell a story. And so I'm a very analytical person, but I that analytical side of me is still in love with story. Mm-hmm. And so I want to, even if I'm not going to tell a bunch of story, a bunch of narrative, I still want to construct my analysis of a text as if it were a story. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to have a built-in little surprise and a twist somewhere where we thought we were going down this road, and surprise, a trap door opens and we go this way. Right. And I'm going to build that in, even in teaching Sunday school classes or preaching a sermon that might be a pretty dry sermon, as far as, you know, there's no stories of puppies being born or grandma dying or anything like that. There's there's none of that pathos necessarily, but I want to construct it in an interesting way that follows a narrative plot. And so that's my preaching in a nutshell. You know, I've never gotten rich and famous being a preacher, and that's okay. I feel like I definitely attract, over the years, I attract people who are intellectually rigorous. I feel like those people tend to come to my church and stay for my preaching a little longer than some. But at the same time, I feel like there's folks that just, they like my humor or whatever. And that seems to appeal to them as well.
How many people say, you know, Jared, I don't really care so much for your preaching or your humor. I just come to hear your caramel voice. That's all.
I can't carry a tune in a 5-gallon bucket, but I do have a good speaking voice.
You do have
a good speaking voice. So I'm blessed with that. I don't know.
Listen, thank
goodness I've got a good voice, because I don't have a lot else working for me. So yeah.
Listen, this is way off the subject, and I hate to break rhythm to tell you this, but I went to Sonic the other day and got a coffee, and I was ordering something for my daughters as well. And the guy came over the intercom, and you know, most of the time,
right?
You know,
right.
You can't. This guy came on. I'm not kidding you. This is exactly how he sounded. Hey, good evening. How are you today? What can I get you? Welcome to Sonic. And I was like, whoa! Like, I was just taken back, and I was like, yeah, I need to get two cold brew vanilla coffees and two sausage burritos, no tots. I think that'll do it. All right, I've got two vanilla cold brews. Those are being made right now as we speak.
That guy's missing his calling.
It was so good. Hey, and then he came out, and I thought, okay, well, I can't wait. This guy comes out. He's like a sophomore or junior in high school. And when he walks up to the deal, he goes, I assume you paid online, so don't worry about anything. Thanks a bunch. And I was like, he walked away. I was just like, wow, like, we're going to have to recruit this guy. Like, we need to get him on the front side.
I was at a roll call yesterday, and there's an officer who was happened to be at that same roll call, that he has a voice like that. And I'm like, man, I've got to get that guy in front of a microphone. Absolutely. I don't even know if he has anything interesting to say, but he's got such a good voice. He needs to use it. Yeah.
I'm waiting on this. This guy could tell me about burritos all day. I don't even care. Like, he just like all day long, just tell me all about it. Tell me what's going on in the kitchen. Does it make any difference? I came home and I told my family. And that's
awesome.
My daughter's just like, yeah, I know that guy. Like, I go to school with that guy. He's got an incredible voice. I was like, this guy's great. Anyway, so yeah, off the subject, but yeah, you do. You have a good speaking voice. When it comes to the analytical side and of you being wired as you are, and preaching, what are some of the pitfalls that that you have in front of you that you have to be aware of? When you are heavy headstrong or heavy headed or very cognitive on that side?
Yeah, anybody in the, if you have the responsibility to stand in the pulpit, you have to be careful about the academic side of you, because the academic side of you is very interested and entertained by big questions. Mm. And you might be tempted then to drop a few of those really big questions out in front of somebody. And you've got years of reading and thinking around it, and you may be very comfortable with it. But for that other person, I mean, they just walked in on Sunday morning. Now you're dropping this really complex thing in their lap, and it might really push them away from the gospel. They're like, oh, Jesus isn't about forgiving my sins or loving me. It's about being able to bend my mind into a pretzel. And mm-hmm. I don't know if I can do that. So I guess this isn't for me. And so we need to respect the fact, not that people are dumber than us or anything like that. That'd be very arrogant, but that you might get enamored with some little tidbit of theological whatever. And we need to not lose the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still comes down to, you know, this Jesus coming to and talking with a person who needed him in that moment. And I'm thinking of like the when he goes to Jairus's daughter, and he, you know, that story is interrupted mm-hmm. midway through because he's passing through the crowd and the woman with the issue of blood runs into him, right?
Right.
And she didn't need a theological argument. She needed help. Yeah. Right. She needed to touch the Savior. Yeah. And wow, we can't lose that. We can't be so enamored with the, you know, how all the theological puzzle pieces fit together that we lose the human element. And I think that's my danger. That's my risk, is that I'm going to get lost inside my head, and the absent-minded professor is going to step into the pulpit and lose everybody for 35 minutes right. because I'm so intrigued by how all these pieces fit together, and they don't hear the human element that touches their lives. And that's a mistake. I really think that's a mistake. There is a place. I've got a shelf behind me full of dusty books, full of complicated theological thoughts. That's where those belong. Right. And they're important. I need to be exposed to them, but I don't need to dump that in the lap of somebody who thinks that their husband might leave them and they can hardly hold it together.
Yeah.
They need to hear that Jesus has answers for them. Yeah. Not that, you know, theological, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Yeah. Or whether or not the word used for the Holy Spirit is in the feminine or the masculine.
Oh yes. Oh, I know. And I've done that so many times where I'm like busting out the Greek grammar to prove that I can do it. And I'm not sure who that's benefiting. I think that's just me patting myself on the back.
Yeah.
And I think, was it Mark Twain that said that humans are the only animal whose head expands when you pat them on the back? Right. That is maybe my own arrogance. That's mm-hmm. not actually any think pastorally useful. Mm-hmm. And so that's a danger. That's a very real risk that we're going to drive people away and think, oh, okay, so it's only the Poindexter types that right. can do this Christianity thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not good. You don't want to have someone leave a presentation of the gospel thinking they need to go look other places.
Yeah. Right. Right. One of the things I've started asking guys, as we do these interviews, I've started asking guys to share the gospel with me. And one of the reasons that I've started doing that is because you know, it's amazing to me how every single time I have an opportunity to sit down and share the gospel with somebody, it's typically coming from an angle that I've never come from this angle before. It's like, so you're starting at this. And it always begins with just absolute brokenness. Like the established like brokenness and need of a savior, like we were talking about earlier.
Right.
You know, but when I hear other people, especially preachers, share the gospel with me, like personally, like, so this is where I begin. Like it gives me such a good structure. Rusty George did a fantastic job when I had asked him this, and mm-hmm. and he walked through these just, and it's just so, it was very just concise and well put together, and And you could tell that this is a thing. Like, I think he's got it on a card in his pocket, and it's a thing. Like, it just rolled out so smooth. But what it does is it gives me perspective on, like, sometimes I forget what the gospel really is supposed to sound like because I haven't mm-hmm. heard it. Do you mind sharing with me the gospel?
I've never been able to connect with the cookie cutter, like, right, here's the right. same gospel presentation I give to everybody. I mean, right. I think there've been people out there who have had great success where literally they have this rehearsed thing that they use to great effect. I've not found that the case. I think that it needs to be tailored to the individual. Hmm. And the common theme that I always fall back on is the uniqueness of Jesus. So every religion offers you some sort of paradise or elevation to a higher plane or some sort of payoff at the end. If you jump through the right hoops, if you work hard enough, if you discipline yourself, you get some sort of payoff. How is Christianity unique in that crowded field? How does it stand out among all of those claims that are all pretty much, I mean, they all kind of look the same. Hmm. And I think with Jesus, there is uniqueness there. Like at a funeral, I go out of my way, usually at the graveside, to talk about the mechanism that exists in Christianity, where we don't just have this promise of an afterlife, but someone has actually gone through it first. Jesus beta tested this for us. Okay. He went out there and he actually rose from the dead, never to die again. And that you don't see that with Muhammad or Confucius or Buddha or anybody else. He's the only one who said, hey, there's something better waiting for you. And I am actually going to go through a death and come back to life again for you to prove that this is a feasible thing. It's not just an empty promise. That kind of trailblazing is really unique to him. And so for people who are grieving in that moment, they need to hear not only an empty platitude or an empty promise, they need to hear that Jesus shed real blood to prove that this works, that this is not just, you know, wishful thinking or, well, I'll keep my fingers crossed, but that in Jesus Christ, he there was an empty tomb to prove that we can live after we die. And so I think everybody's going to have something going on in their life where Jesus is uniquely the right answer. And lots of other lesser answers are available through all kinds of self-help and other religions and other philosophies. But it's only Jesus that gives you the full, complete, unique answer. And that uniqueness ought to, when it clicks that, oh, wow, he actually is the only one who completely addresses this for me, that's when the hair goes up on your arms and on the back of your neck. And that's the presentation of the gospel that's going to stick with them. That's the one that's going to be like, okay, I'm going to carry this with me for the rest of my life. Yeah. And so I think it has to be tailored, but I think at the same time, the Christian has to be ready to present that, because the good news is Jesus is the answer in all of those situations. So whatever you have a deep father wound, you have, you're grieving the loss of a loved one. You've just lost your security in life because your job is being eliminated or something. Every single one of those issues that we experience in our human experience, Jesus perfectly meets those needs. He perfectly speaks to that wound or that hurt or that insecurity. He does it perfectly every time. And man, we need to hear that, you know, and then sins are forgiven and everything else too. I mean, there's this all, it just never ends. And so we have this wealth of topics to draw from to show that Christ is our hope, our answer. And that's what a good presentation of the gospel needs to have.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that. And it is, and you know, it's moments like that when you know that the Holy Spirit is present and you begin to share and it's like, well, I've never approached from this angle, mm-hmm. man, the metaphor is good. I mean, most of my life is lived in stories anyway. I think in stories, yeah. and
Well, the old patterns that we've had in our culture for the last 200 years are fading away. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you could trot out a string of Bible verses.
Right.
And in a previous generation, that had impact. That was effective. It was convincing. You could string together 8 or 10 Bible verses and mm-hmm. walk someone through like the book of Romans, and it really changed hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. But our children don't read the Bible right. in our culture. It certainly hasn't been used in schools for a couple generations now. And we don't have this cultural foundation of Christian knowledge. We don't have that backstory built into us. We have Iron Man and Spider-Man and Thor. We know that backstory,
that's right.
but we don't have the Bible backstory as part of our cultural heritage. We've lost that.
Yeah.
And so trotting out a bunch of scripture is going to be very ineffective with an unchurched person. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to meet them where they're at and explain some real basic concepts about Jesus and about God, because they don't bring that with them to start with. And so evangelism has absolutely changed in the last 100 years in our culture, and we have to be able to adapt. The great thing is, you put the gospel of Jesus on a level playing field, it wins everywhere. It works in communist China. Yep. It works in South America. It works in overly affluent United States. It works everywhere if it's just given a try.
Yep.
And so, I mean, that's not the Chesterton quote that Christianity has not been tried and found wanting, but it's not been tried and found wanting. It's not. It's not been tried and found wanting. It's been found hard and not tried.
There you go.
Isn't that it? Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
Okay, so favorite author butchered the quotation.
Yeah, that's all right.
Yes. Well, score one for me. Yeah.
Well, you know, go back to what you were saying. When you think about how the United States, like North America, like we have more doubts about scripture and God and salvation. Yeah. And we have so many doubts about that. And trying to explain to people is like, well, then why, if it's so great, why aren't we seeing it? I went through a series and we were talking about the book of Acts and how what you see is this passage in Acts 2. And they spent all their time breaking bread with one another, listening to the apostles, praying, singing hymns, you know, and it's like, so why don't we see this? And this was like a thing that happened daily, and multiple people came to the Lord all the time. It's like, so if we plug it into our American mindset, this is what we think. So we should have church every day at each other's houses, and then more people would come. It's like, no, like yes, if you're gonna distill it to a formula, yeah, that would be the formula. Unfortunately, it would be absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. The problem is that where we are, we really don't need that. We just don't need that. You know, in our own mind, we don't need that.
Right.
Like, because we're not running for our lives. No. We're not being hunted. No. We're not being taxed to 90%. We're not being persecuted for our beliefs. You know,
people in our culture today have no appreciation. This is where being a student of history helps, but we have no appreciation for how high the baseline has been raised.
Mm-hmm.
Most people were surrounded by death. If you had a family, right. you lost children. That was just normal that you had children that died, and that your family members, that many of them would not live past their 50s or 60s. Mm-hmm. That was just normal. Yeah. Now we just expect to live to be 80. That seems tragic. I mean, Betty White died recently at 99, and people are like, oh, I can't believe she went so soon. 99. We have obviously lost touch with how the rest of the human race has lived for thousands of years in most of the world, that we think that is somehow tragic to die at 99.
Yeah.
We've never had a people so pampered and affluent and spoiled. And just like Solomon, it did not do us well spiritually to have all of this luxury.
Exactly. So, right. Yeah. Well, listen, two things. I think about when you talk about like age and the things that we struggle with and why we can't make faith a more important part of our life in North America. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the movie 12 Strong? It's nope. About the group.
Oh, it's the Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I think they end up calling them the Horse Warriors or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Time. Special Forces in Afghanistan ahead of everybody else. Yeah.
So, the American commander is talking to General Dostum, who's, I can't remember where he's from, but he's a warlord.
And yeah, in the northern part of Afghanistan.
That's right. And so this Afghani warlord looks at the American commander and he says, "You know what the problem is with your people? Is that your life, it looks better than your afterlife."
Mm.
Like, yes. Your perspective is that your life looks better than your, like, you can't imagine an afterlife that's better than the life you have.
Yeah.
For us, and he goes on to tell him, for us, no. Like, no, our life is tragic. So our afterlife, like, all our dreams and our hopes are in that place. Yeah. That's why you can't fight. That's why you're a warrior in your head, but you're not a warrior in your heart. I mean, there's a real strong message in the middle.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Real strong message. On the other part, when you're talking about Solomon, let me share this with you. And August 7th, I believe, me and a buddy went skydiving up at Skydive Kansas City, which they fly out of Butler, Missouri.
Yeah.
And we've kind of got some phrases that we use around the church. You know, when a man invites you to go be a part of his life, to go do something exciting, your response should be, "That's a terrible idea. What time are we leaving?" Like, that should be your response. And so a text message came from one of the guys in our church, sent out this text message, and the text message says, "Signed up to go skydiving August 7th. Who's going with us?" And I was desperately hoping my calendar was full. Just like, oh no. Of course, the text messages started coming back in. No way. You know, I'm going to be in Florida. You know, somebody else didn't even answer. Man, I look at my calendar and I'm just like, oh man, I hope there's something. I call my wife. I'm like, "Hey, August 7th, we got anything going on?" "No, I don't think so." "Double check." Like, double check. Yes. Like, I ain't trying to be a part of this. And she's come back, no, like, "It's clear." And I was like, "Son of God." So I just responded, unfortunately, "That's a terrible idea. Unfortunately, I don't have anything on that day." So August 7th, we go. And incredible. Have you ever gone? Have you ever gone skydiving?
No.
Okay.
My number of takeoffs, my number of landings match perfectly.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not in that camp, but we go 14,000 feet. They open the door. Your brain starts just doing just somersaults because somebody opened the door on a plane and you're thinking to yourself, like, this is like every action movie you've ever seen. Like, you know what happens next. Somebody opens a door on a plane, you're going, like, somebody's getting sucked out the door. Like, you know, this is how this goes. Like, so people start just going out. And I was the last one. And my guy goes out. So it's me, my tandem guy, and the pilot. And we get to the door. One, two, and they go on two, which is tricky. One, two, and we go. 14,000 feet. And it's a free fall of 60 seconds. And so approximately a 2 mile drop, approximately. And they pull the chute and we coast down, we get to the ground. There's a whole lot of just really cool detail in there. I'll skip over. We got to the ground. It was one of the coolest experiences, one of the best dopamine bumps I've ever got in my entire life. And here's what I realized. 10 minutes after that, I was sad. And all I could think about was Solomon. And the only thing I could think was this: he was right.
Yeah.
If that's the best, according to me, that's the very best. There's
most
not
exhilarating moment that's of your
the,
life.
The very
and it
most
doesn't stick with you for 5 minutes. Yep. Yes. Yep.
10 minutes after. And I thought to myself, it's true.
Well, and just like a drug
out there. Yeah.
Just like a drug, every jump after that will be a little less thrilling. You know, it'll be close, but it won't quite pay off like the first one did.
Well, that's right. Because that's
how that works.
Anxiety level had never been so high and it will never be that high again.
Right. Right. Now you have in Butler, you have the added relief when you land that your last 60 seconds of life was not looking at Missouri. And so, okay, I can still make it back into God's country. And so
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we're, it was incredible. But I remember like when we got to the ground, it was like, it's true. Like, yeah. You know, it's true. Like inside, you know, it's true.
But we can't help ourselves. That's part of the brokenness in us. We think, well, I just need another, $10,000. I just need another, high, be it material or sexual or whatever. We think that's going to finally give us what we want. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't.
No,
it never pays off. It's so fleeting. It's here and it's gone. And it's like, oh, well, can I have another? Mm-hmm. And that's the way that always works. And that's back to what I was saying about the gospel. Jesus is the only one that's going to really satisfy us too. Mm-hmm. And so every one of our needs where this world falls short, it's only going to be in Christ that we really find a lasting answer.
That's right.
So every single category, I think it's applicable.
Yeah. I was reading something about the Enneagram the other day, and it was talking about Enneagram sevens. And what it said is that when they are in creating mode, they are always good. When they are in consuming mode, there's never enough. And so it's always create over consume all the time. It's create over consume. And that was what, it, that's what it, I mean, it's, tr- that's true for me over and over, that it's all about, we look out into the world and we say, the world's broken. I need to create something and put something out there into it. But when I go out into the world and I start taking what's there, like that's what empties me. It fills me to give. Yeah. It empties me to take, you know? And it's like, like that became a new, I was like, yeah, it's true. Like I have to continue to create, put stuff out into the world. Like that's what you, because otherwise I'm empty. So
yeah.
One question. And then let's talk about the chaplaincy thing. Car guys, they know certain things about cars. Mm-hmm. They see details. I'm a Porsche 911 lover. I love Porsche 911s. You should see my Instagram. It's all about jujitsu and cats and some dudes I know who have guns and Porsche 911s. It's always Porsche 911. I just love them. Absolutely.
Okay.
Car guys know cars. Good singers, good vocalists. They're listening to a certain thing. What do you notice as a preacher when you hear somebody preaching and they're doing something? What are the things you're looking for? What perks up your antennas?
Really any public speaker, because that's part of doing the chaplain thing, is I'm around the city and county government a little bit more. I'm occasionally giving an invocation or a benediction at any kind of event or even commissioner's meeting or whatever. And so I hear people speaking publicly a lot. And wow, there are some really good folks that just have a natural talent, or people who've been trained. And then there's a whole mess of people who don't communicate effectively. And especially in a setting like that, where you've got them for a few minutes and you need to make it count. People that wander all over the place. And I've never been a fan, like in back in church, you've got so much time with them. And I have long sermons, 40 minutes is pretty regular, but to waste the first 2 minutes on a joke that is not connected to the rest of the sermon, man, I hate that. I think that came from like a circuit writer, preachers, revival speakers, people who were coming in from the outside, they were strangers. And that opening joke was a way of winning a little bit of favor, a way of, hey, give me a chance, I'm funny. And I get that for them. But if you're preaching to the same crowd every day, you need to cut that joke. You need to get rid of that. Because that to me seems like you are not paying attention to your craft. You are doing something out of reflex. And it's not necessary, and you're wasting time. And it mortifies me to think that anyone out in the audience is perceiving that as wasted time, because this is your chance to talk about Jesus. So what are you doing telling a knock-knock joke or whatever? I just, that makes my skin crawl. Yeah. And so there's time and place. I mean, look it up. We're having this long conversation right here on this podcast. This is, there's places for meandering and... Sure. and shooting the breeze and that kind of thing. There's a place for that. The pulpit's probably not one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I worry about technical stuff, and I'm paranoid for myself because I want to include everything. I want to have a 4-hour sermon, right? Because I have, sure, 4 hours worth of notes. Mm-hmm. And so I have become a critic of myself. Okay, I'm going to cut this out. I love it, but I'm going to cut it out. And it's hard. It's hard to lose that thing that you love. You so desperately want to wedge it in there, no matter how, mm-hmm, badly it fits. You want it to be there because you're in love with it, but you need to let it go. You need to be a harsh editor. And like I said, I'm taking at least a couple hours worth of material and trimming it down to what I hope is the best 40 minutes that I've got. And I hate it when I see others that don't seem to care. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, I'm just going to kind of give you whatever's on the top of my mind. And that seems disrespectful to the role of the preacher and the importance of the pulpit. I kind of wish we'd get serious about our craft again. And so that's the kind of nitpicking that I do. And, mm-hmm, and I, like I said, I hope a lot of that nitpicking is directed at myself first.
Sure.
But yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's times when you hear something and you're just like, ugh, don't, please stop. Yeah, yeah. No more. Like quit. Yeah.
Well,
quit.
And that's why we should listen to ourselves. That's why we should go back and re-listen. Listen to your sermons. Almost everybody records nowadays. And so go back and listen. And if you can't get through one listen of your sermon, then why are you expecting your congregation to get through it? Okay. I mean, really. And so you need to craft your sermon. You need to spend enough time on your sermon that you would be willing to listen to it once on Monday.
Yeah.
And then maybe you're getting to the point where you're listenable to a random selection of civilians out there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, thank you for that. That's good. And that's good. That's convicting for me too, because man, that's really easy for me. It's really easy for me to get in that place of, oh, here's a thought. I should talk.
Yeah. Oh, I'm the worst. I am the apprehended professor, but a good leader doesn't have anyone to do something that we would be willing to do.
Right.
And so we better be willing to listen to ourselves, and it will help us hone our craft and become more effective in communicating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when it comes to this chaplaincy, like where you are with chaplaincy, you've been doing this for 4 years, mm-hmm, or just over 4 years.
Yep. Seen lots of dead bodies.
Yeah.
And all kinds of things that should not be joked about.
Yeah. But in those circles,
they're going to joke about,
that's right.
It's like, oh, how do I react?
Yeah. That's right. Well, here's for guys out there who don't realize this, guys who are in the local church, mm-hmm, and there is a police department there. There's a fire department. There's a sheriff's department. There's, you know, whatever it is. Like, that's a big freaking deal. Like, if you can get involved in that,
yeah.
Like I've heard you say this before, when it comes to like, we need more bodies, like we need warm, yes, bodies in this, yes, in this place. How did you get involved?
It was so organic or so many years that, like I said, I had cops in my church. I was going out. I had responded to a couple different suicides because not because the police department asked me to respond, but because people who were involved asked me to respond. Mm-hmm. And so I had been on crime scenes a few times, and I'd had cops that were, you know, personal friends of mine. And it just bothered me that they weren't getting more support and more help. And I think the tipping point for me was finding out that some of these young cops have to do death notifications, mm-hmm, and they have to go tell someone at 6 o'clock in the morning that their teenager was killed in a car wreck. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, wait a second. So you've got to do all of these other life and death things, but you also have to do that. Well, I can do that. I've been doing funerals for 25 years. So let me get the training to specifically go do a death notification. And nowadays that's what happens. If that pager goes off, I will, if it's a death notification, I will get the information. I'll meet the officer and then I'll say, I'll take over. Okay. I'll knock on the door. I'll make the notification. I'll do all the little steps that go into that, so it's effective and good. And then if they have questions, I'll hand it over to the detective or whoever else might be with me, but let me do that. And so that's done. Lost track now of the people that I've done notifications every hour of the day. every type of death, from suicides to car accidents to homicides, drug deals gone bad, and everything else. People killed by other civilians and people killed by cops, and all kinds of things. And so, so that's been part of it, is the death notification part. But I was trained by guys who were not only law enforcement chaplains, but also they had experience in the military. And chaplaincy kind of has two different hats. You have short-term relationship chaplaincy, where like a hospital chaplain that deals with somebody, they're in the hospital for 2 weeks because they've got some serious illness, and that chaplain is there, and it's a resource and is very helpful, but it's short-term. You may never see them again. Mm-hmm. And when I go out to a crime scene and there's a family standing at the yellow tape, that's the type of ministry I have there. It's short term. I'm going to deal with them for a couple hours and probably never see them again. But the military chaplains are embedded with their unit for a year or more. And so they have a long-term relationship with the people who are doing the work, not the victims, but the helpers. And so law enforcement chaplaincy also has that element, where I'm not just helping the families of victims, I'm also trying to build a long-term relationship with these officers. And that is what I was talking about earlier about getting behind the badge. It may take years. I mean, easily 18 months. Let's just assume that's the minimum. It's going to take you 18 months to begin to be trusted by some of the officers. And so that's 18 months of attending their meetings or doing ride-alongs or just being involved. And for me, I feel like I needed to be out there. I needed to go and be in their roll calls and their roll call meetings. Starting a shift, that meeting may only be 5 minutes. I mean, literally, it's like, hey, we're looking for this car and this suspect. Make sure you fill out this form correctly next time. And we have an FOP meeting next week. Chaplain, do you have anything? Nope. I'm just visiting. Okay. End of meeting. I mean, the whole meeting was 5 minutes tops. But I was there, and I was exposed to what they're exposed to, including all the minutia and the boring stuff. And I'm building rapport over time, and it takes a long time to do it. But at the end, they're not, if there's a critical incident, they're not going to respond to somebody who they don't know.
That hasn't been present.
That hasn't been present. Right. Yeah. That ministry of presence, where you are there and familiar and you've built rapport, that is critical for most of them. There's a few people who are like, oh, you have chaplain printed on the back of your shirt. Okay. I'll talk to you. But that's the rare exception.
Right.
Most first responders, they're not going to open up unless they trust you. And so it's all kinds of work proactively in advance to build that rapport before they are going to turn to you for help.
Yeah. I've heard you say that before. I've heard you say, you know, this is a ministry of presence. This is a ministry of presence that it's very much waiting. It's very much waiting. Like there's tragedy is coming and, but you need to be present.
Yeah. Well, you can count on that these officers, I mean, it is possible, especially in smaller departments, that an officer may, you know, in a very small department, he may never pull his gun. In a medium-sized department, he may never shoot his gun in the line of duty, let alone actually hit or kill somebody. I mean, he may literally never pull the trigger in 25 years of being an officer. But the bigger the department, the more types of urgent, critical calls that they get, the more likely that'll happen. And then sometimes there's just that outlier where you are a rural sheriff deputy in the middle of nowhere, but you have a life or death encounter where you've got to pull your gun and shoot somebody. And those officer involved shootings are extremely difficult to work through. And everybody's supposed to act tough and like, oh, this didn't bother me. And hey, it was a good shoot. It was justified. It was to protect somebody or to defend my life. But it has a tremendous impact on somebody to go through that. And there are police officers who have shot somebody, shot a bad guy, like a drug dealer who was going to kill somebody. And they shoot that person. And in that moment, quietly, and they don't ever tell anybody until years later, but they'll go up and apologize to the dead body and say, hey, I'm sorry I had to shoot you, you know, and I'm angry at you for making me shoot you, but I wish I didn't have to do this.
Yeah.
And who do they tell that to? I mean, really, they can't go home and tell their wife that. Yeah. They don't want to admit that they had these mixed feelings to their coworkers, because they don't want to look like they're not reliable. And so who do they tell if they have nightmares, sleeplessness, you know, flashbacks, whatever? And I'm not talking full-blown PTSD, but they just were bothered by it. Who do they talk to? And there should be some sort of department psychiatrist or psychologist. There's peer support and there's chaplains, but many times all three of those are pretty unfamiliar to the officer, or they don't trust, you know, they feel weird talking to peer support, because peer support may be people that they actually work with and could be involved in future promotions and discipline, and they don't want to admit what's going on in their personal lives there and how they're dealing with it. And so there's just a real reluctance to use any of those resources.
Yeah.
And I want to be a good, reliable, steadfast resource that they've known for years, and they know they can trust me. And if they want to come talk to me, they can. And I want to be available if they're willing to do that.
Yeah. It goes back to that thing we were talking about earlier with the steadfastness. It's like you show up and you're present in that, like the steadfastness of like, I just need to be in this place, because I believe, and you know, it comes back to that. God's going to use us. He's going to open up these doors. Like we need to be able to shovel as much light into the darkness as we possibly can, you know?
Absolutely.
And that's the goal. That's the goal. One of our previous conversations, we talked about how sometimes when guys go into ministry, it's and you'd said something along these lines before. Guys go into ministry, and we know there's a, especially young guys, like we know there's a call of ministry on our life, and then you look at the landscape of what you see, and it's just like it's just this sea of effeminate, boring, drab. Tasks before
unheroic,
and that's the way it seems.
Very wishy-washy,
and you're not you got dishpan hands, you know, from washing communion cups, whatever it might be, and it's like, yeah, all my buddies are working, all my buddies are, you know, but this chaplaincy thing. It has a little bit of
If that's your problem, this will scratch that itch.
Yeah.
Because there's so few jobs where you could potentially come in as a helper, in our case, you know, ministers of the gospel. There's very few jobs where we could come into their workplace and interact with them. Most of my church members, I don't have that kind of access.
That's right.
But I've gone through the training and gotten, you know, signed off on all the non-disclosure forms and everything else and waivers and such. And now I have, you know, I have this little name badge here, and I can wave it in front of the door, and the door opens and I can walk right in the police station.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unique access, and it's exciting. And I'm not someone who ever wanted to be a cop. I still don't want to be a cop.
Right.
I want to be a chaplain. That's right. But I'm cop adjacent. And so they're doing amazing things. And I've been in the car with them when incredible, you know, it's greatest show on earth. It's really amazing work that they do. And I've been right there next to them, and I've looked up and down the gutters in the street for shell casings and you know, just to assist, you know.
Yeah,
I'm not
part of
the investigation proper, but I'm just kind of an extra pair of eyes for them. And I've been there when, you know, we weren't sure if the shooter was standing there in the crowd at the yellow tape. And there's people who have their hands in their pockets, and they're making menacing gestures and whatever. And you're like, is this going to get bad?
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite the experience. And so I'm not trying to glamorize it, but it is exciting work, and it's fulfilling work to help these guys. If you're so in love with it that you want to join, then you need to go to the academy and become a police officer. But if you would just like to help them, you could come alongside them in some of these cases and experience what they experience. And that's not always the fun, exciting thing. Sometimes it's standing at the yellow tape in the sleet at 3 a.m, freezing, but someone has to guard that crime scene. And so the chaplain is going to go out there and stand with that officer And I think that's a valuable thing to experience as well. And so it is exciting. It's fun. It's interesting because I'm an outsider, but every now and again, I kind of get brought in to the brotherhood and I'm still an outsider. I'm not a sworn officer, but every now and again, they speak of, you know, lovingly, protectively, you know, like, hey, we're going to take care of the chaplain and we're going to make sure he's safe, or we're going to, you know, tell him we appreciate that he's here, that kind of thing. And that means a lot to me. My masculine need for camaraderie is fed by that.
That's great.
Now, the problem is people are drawn to that. They want to wear the shirt or the jacket that says chaplain on the back. They want to be close to the excitement and all the action. And that's dangerous because that draws people into chaplaincy that do not belong there. They can't make a distinction between themselves and the law enforcement officer. Like I said, if you want to go catch bad guys, you need to go to join the academy and become a cop. If you can't, there's no shortcut into, well, I'm going to help solve this crime. That's not our role. The chaplain's not there to solve the crime. Chaplain's not there to chase the bad guy. I mean, obviously, if the bad guy's running right past me, I might stick a foot out and trip him.
There you go.
But yeah, but I'm not there to get involved, and I have to keep that distinction clear.
Yeah.
It'd be inappropriate for me to go out and think I'm going to go hunt bad guys. That's not my job.
Right.
And so we wrestle with not having enough chaplains in our world. I really feel like, you know, every department across the nation could use more chaplains, but a lot of the volunteers are going to be people who should never be chaplains. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking for just the right man or woman who has the right attitude about being a helper and can keep a clear distinction in their mind about whether or not they're the law enforcement or they're adjacent to the law enforcement. Right. And they need to be able to keep that clear in their head. And the people who can do that are good helpers. The people who come with no ulterior motives are good helpers. But too many people are like, oh, well, I want to be a chaplain so I can get all the firefighters to come to my church. You can't do that. These first responders, especially cops, they're going to sniff that out, and they're going to know that you've got an ulterior motive, that you're basically using them. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to be there. I mean, it's a secular entity. The law enforcement agency is a secular entity, and legally you have to provide secular services. You need to be there for basically officer wellness, for their psychological health. If they want to ask you about church, well, then you can talk about it all day long, but you can't come in there and start preaching and praying and doing all these things. They have to initiate it. If you initiate it, you're in violation of what the Supreme Court says is acceptable for a chaplain to do. And you're probably going to end up losing that access.
Yeah.
So finding chaplains and finding chaplains with the right attitude, that's difficult because we don't get that many volunteers and we have to weed out 3/4 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's frustrating.
What's the first step? What's the first step in getting involved? You decide you want to be a chaplain and you want to go.
In most places, I mean, there are some places like where I was, there was already a chaplains association. And so I approached the chaplains association and asked, okay, what training do I need to get? What's the procedure for applying and getting interviewed by the department and all that kind of thing. But in a lot of places, you could just ask the local sheriff or the local police chief, and there may not be a program. And you should still go get all that training. There's plenty of places, especially online, where you can find really good trainers that are in your neck of the woods, or you can do it over the internet and get the proper training and credentials that you need. But just showing up and helping, I mean, there's probably a lot of sheriffs who would just appreciate, well, if we had a pastor drop in once a week or even once a month and did that over the course of several years, then there's a resource that if we have a critical incident, we know who we can trust and who we have familiarity with.
Right.
And so I would, in most places, I would just start asking questions. Hey, I'd like to be a chaplain. Who do I go to? Mm-hmm. And they may or may not be ready for you. A lot of places don't have chaplains programs, but almost all of them are open to it, especially if you're one of those trustworthy individuals that have a clear idea about where the boundaries are.
Yeah. When the defund the police was really in its kind of fever pitch, What was going on where you guys were?
Kansas City was affected. We had some riots on the Missouri side in Kansas City, Missouri. There are two different, some people don't realize there's two different towns, both named Kansas City, both adjacent to one another. And so there's Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. Kansas City, Missouri is larger. And they had some riots. It burned a vehicle or two, but it mostly was kept under control. There were a few bad incidences, a few bad moments, but it wasn't anything like what you saw in Portland or Seattle or places like that. Kansas City, Kansas, we had a great relationship between the department and our citizens, primarily through our community policing. We have police officers who are really focused on getting out into the community. And we have for the size of our department, relatively large unit that just is like, hey, let's help the elderly. Let's clean up trash. Let's fix all the graffiti and that kind of thing. And that built enough rapport that we didn't see any of the riots ever get any traction. There were groups that protested and it all just fizzled out and went away without ever getting violent. Mm-hmm. And so our officers had their riot gear ready, but to my knowledge, never had to use it. That's and great. So that was good. But it's still demoralizing because the defund the police, their sentiment still filtered down to our officers, and it was demoralizing and discouraging
to
them.
Sure.
They felt like, why am I doing this job? I'm risking my life. It's traumatizing. It's difficult. It's stressful. It's ruining my marriage. Why am I doing this if people don't even want me here?
Right.
And that was really hard. And that led to, an opportunity for a chaplain to give a word of encouragement and a smile and, sometimes a shoulder to cry on or whatever, but just be present and, sure. and be helpful. And that was good. It was an opportunity to build some rapport and some trust. And I think people responded well to the chaplains being there.
Yeah. You couldn't help but feel like, these people that are screaming to defund the police. They're yelling from a stage that was built freedom fighters who are creating enough peace in their own existence and the existence of the lives of those around them so that you could actually protest these people for what they've done. It's like, built this massive, pedestal for you to come and speak on, and then from there this is what you're going to talk about.
There's a bit of tone deafness to the person who's living in their mother's basement and grandma buys them a ballistic helmet or bulletproof vest on Amazon and that truck delivers it to their house. It's not hijacked by bandits. It's delivered to their house and they put it on. They go down there and yell at police officers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, your whole life is possible because there's people out there keeping you safe allowing the delivery truck and grandma and everyone else to live their lives and be safe. And there's just, it's so tone deaf. It's a very childish kind of thing, but I think Marxism in general is childish. Yeah. I think it's a religion. And I feel like I can say that with some authority as a religious professional. It's a religion that says that we can have heaven on earth. We can have utopia. And you other people who are greedy and want money, you're getting in the way of heaven on earth happening. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to get violent. Yeah. And it's a temper tantrum. It is a foolish, childish view of the world. And I don't really apologize for feeling that way.
No, I agree 100%. I agree 100%. Like it's a dark, dark, it's such a dark and you know what? And here's my other problem with it. It's easier
to break an egg than to lay one.
Yeah.
And so there are people out there who are like, my life isn't perfect, or there's something about it that I don't like. And so I'm going to burn it all down. Mm-hmm. But those are people who've never built anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sorry for interrupting you.
No, it's just, it's the same with comedians. I feel the same way with comedians. When I listen to a comedian who was intelligent, And he is getting, like, he is utilizing some serious skill to accomplish his set, to put the jokes together, to do the setup, to do the punchline, to do all that. It's well thought out. My problem with the Marxism idea is that it is just, it's gutless at its inception and absolutely selfish. I mean, it's just so me oriented, and it loses all intellectual value to me. Like, when I look at it and I'm like, how in the, like, and that's the problem for me, but I'm kind of on a thing right now to where I'm really exhausted with this idea of people just not wanting to think. Like, let's just think a little bit. Like, let's just put a little energy into thinking this through, you know? I mean, that's just frustrating. And so, I'm with you. I'm with you. Like, it's so infantile. It's just so infantile.
Me.
Give me what I want. There is a podcast called Hey Chaplain by Jared Altick. And, I've listened to a few episodes, and there's some really, you've got some pretty heavy hitters on your podcast.
I've been blessed. I've got a lot of, law enforcement people in my life, and they have a lot of connections. And so I've got, in fact, I just did an interview. It's an unpublished episode so far, but I just did an interview yesterday with a guy in Florida, and I'm really excited about that one coming out. I've had people talk about officer wellness from a lot of different points of view, and people from all over the country, from Washington, D.C. to L.A. to Florida to wherever, and some right here in Kansas City, and they are able to share wisdom and encouragement. And so that's my goal with that podcast. I don't make any money off of it, completely non-monetized, but my goal is to put wisdom and encouragement from other officers and other chaplains and people who are involved out there, so that the law enforcement community can be encouraged. I'm trying to push back against Antifa and defund the police and BLM and all these other groups that are trying to tear things down. This is a noble profession. And I want people in law enforcement to be encouraged. I want them to hear wisdom about how to navigate big problems and small problems and all the different aspects of their life and different types of careers they have. I just want to keep putting that message out there. And I've had a lot of success with it. It's like I said, I'm not really advertising it per se, but it's all throughout. I mean, I've got listeners all throughout the country and 25 foreign countries and people that are listening and tuning in and really appreciating it. And so it's a fun little thing I'm doing on the side, and I don't make a new episode every day. You know, it's just a couple month, and it's going really well. So I tell people if you like what you heard, share it with a cop or someone who loves a cop. Mm-hmm. And that's the audience I'm trying to reach and trying to encourage.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're doing. Appreciate your work at Wyandotte County Christian Church. Appreciate your work with the police department as well. And I think that's all noble stuff. And thanks for coming on this podcast and not being one of those idiots that just drones on about stuff that doesn't make any sense. I like smart people. This is what Listen, I want to keep being the dumbest guy in my circle. This is what it comes down to. If somebody else comes in and takes over that seat, Jared, I get so irritated. Like, I want to be the dumb one in the circle.
I appreciate getting a chance to talk about it. I love talking about the church. That's my passion. But the chaplain thing is an extension of what I do at the church.
Yeah.
And the podcasting is an extension of that. Yeah. And so to me, it all, you know, Russian nesting doll style, it's all,
right.
You know, a call within a call. Yeah. And I love where I'm at right now with all that. I really like doing it. I like talking about it. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. It's a very, very organic thing, very organic growth that's happening with that. So that's valuable. Yeah. When we talk about guys who they may want to get involved, what's the very first place they should check? They go online. They're going to need to take some courses. They're going to need to get certified in something. They're going to need to register with the chaplain.
Some places are only going to need you to be an ordained minister of some sort.
Okay.
Others are going to want really specific chaplaincy training.
Okay.
And that might mean CPE, like if you were training to be a hospital chaplain, but usually it could be, you know, a series of short, like weekend courses and kind of a, here's a chaplaincy boot camp or chaplaincy 101. And there's several organizations around the country that provide that kind of training. And so, and it's a kind of training, it's like continuing ed. You can just keep building on it and keep learning more and more. I really feel like as a minister, I already knew 90% of what I needed to know. Mm-hmm. It just needed some godly common sense to go into the police station and not get in the way and not interfere and not try to promote myself. And, you know, it just, if you have any sense about you at all, about how to be a helper, chaplaincy is not hard. And a lot of places really, really appreciate that you care enough to keep showing up. And so if you can be consistent, that's the key. So if you're out, you know, really small city or big city, whatever, talk to, you know, send out some sort of thing, ask, is there a chaplain's organization already? And if so, you're going to be directed to them and they will tell you what training they require. If there's no chaplain's organization of any sort in the county or city where you're at, then I think you talk to the police chief, you talk to the sheriff, and you ask, can I get involved? What will you allow? And you yield to whatever they want. They may limit your access at first, but if you're in the long game, I mean, eventually you're going to be a trusted part mm-hmm. of their system and they're going to want you there and they're going to give you access. They may not do it at first, but they will eventually. Mm-hmm. So perfect. If you play the long game and you have the right attitude about it, then you will eventually earn their trust. If you don't, you'll burn them. You'll probably ruin the chances for other chaplains to get in. And we'll all resent you. And so
perfect. Yep. Perfect. I think it's a great note to end on. I appreciate that. So Jared Altick, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being on the Homeless Podcast and good luck with your podcast and
thank you.
And the guest that you're going to have on. I'm looking forward to hearing some more.
Thank you. God bless you.
I appreciate it.